Hello everyone and welcome to this CCWG on Enhancing Accountability meeting number 39 on the 7th of July 2015. We have a nice agenda for today and we will be reminding, of course, as usual, about your statement of interest. If there's anyone that hasn't filled in their statement of interest so far, please do so at your earliest convenience. And please feel free to reach out for staff if you need any help with that. The roll call will be, as usual, from those who are in the Adult Connect room. And if there is anyone at this point that is not in the Adult Connect room, but is, in fact, in the phone bridge, could you please state your name so we can add it to the roll call?
Good morning, Leon. This is Keith Drazik. I'm on the phone only this morning.
Thanks, Keith. Staff, could you please add Keith Drazik to the attendance list? Is there anyone else besides Keith Drazik in the phone bridge?
Hi, Leon. Cheryl here. I'm not in the IC room yet, but I will be joining shortly.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Anyone else?
Greg Shatton as well on his way into the room.
Thank you, Greg. Anyone else? Okay, so I think roll call is done. And I don't know if Mathieu has already logged. Yes, he's logged into the AC room. So with no delay, I'll turn to Mathieu for the next agenda item.
Thank you very much, Leon, and hello, everyone, for this 39th call, which will be we'll spend a significant amount of our time listening to a presentation by our independent counsel. But before that, we have a couple of synchronization and administrative items to make sure everyone's in line with the preparations for the face-to-face meeting in Paris in just a little more than a week's time now. So first item is a quick update on the working parties regarding their work plans towards this face-to-face meeting. And I don't know if Jordan is already on the line. Can I see Jordan?
Becky is.
Oh, Becky, you've already joined. That's great
news.
I hope you have a lot of coffee with you. So, Becky, can you please start just informing about the upcoming calls you've set up for Work Party 2 so everyone has a view on this?
Yes, we have calls set up for Wednesday, so tomorrow and Monday, focus in on getting the actual work done. I have circulated to the group a annotated comment tool. It's still missing the comments on reconsideration that I'm working on, and that should go out soon. But I hope in advance, first of all, I hope people who can will really try to make the calls, and second of all, hope people will get a chance to look at the annotated comment tool. I think, we have fairly discreet but some significant issues to discuss in terms of suggestions that came in on the mission core values and commitment statement and on the IRP and reconsideration.
Thanks, Becky. Jordan, I know it's midnight your time now, but can you still provide us a similar update of where Work Party 1 is and next steps?
Sure, Mathieu, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Okay, so we had one call on Monday, and we've got a call on Wednesday, a call on Friday, and a call next Monday. We're working through basically groups of volunteers preparing draft content for the second public comment report. So they're redrafting the content from the first based on the public comments received and on the discussions in Buenos Aires. And the working party is working through that last content. We've gone through the AOC into bylaws stuff. Most of that was okay. we're doing the community powers, the whether the mechanism is a voting mechanism or a group of people gathering to discuss issues, and the voting rates within the mechanism, still to be worked through in the coming calls, and we'll come back to AOC as well. So that's the kind of process we're on. We're going to do that text updating before Paris and have that done for the freeze, and then after Paris we'll do the updating of the public comment tool with the result of responses to all of the public comments that were made from PC1.
Thanks, Jordan. And then we have Work Party 3, which has just had its first call yesterday. And maybe, Leon, you can update on how you're planning to address the work on Work Party 3.
Yes, Matthew, thank you. This is Leon Sanchez. Yes, we had our first call yesterday. And the long story short is that we will be dividing work with regards to the emerging issues into three subgroups. Each of the subgroups will have a look at the current documents that are already in place within ICANN structure to see to make an inventory of those mechanisms that already take care of staff accountability, SOAC accountability, and diversity. And, of course, if we don't have anything in place, we will. Our next step will be to create a list of areas in which we can work to further discuss in our Paris meeting. And I think this is so far what we can report on Work Party 3. And, well, yes, that will be it.
Thank you, Liam. As you see, I think this there's a common trend here of a lot of volunteer time being dedicated to the group and a lot of things to be produced ahead of the meeting in Paris. So I would summarize it as all volunteers with a little bit of availability, please join on deck. We really need everyone's hands to have a successful meeting in Paris. And while we're doing this, I think a short number of key principles can help us focus on what really matters for moving our work further. One of these is probably to stay focused on the issues where when we have wide support not to reopen the issues. And I'd like to remind everyone that we've had tremendous summaries of the public comment one that were produced ahead of Buenos Aires. So when there's a discussion about whether there was consensus on a point or we got feedback, I would really encourage everyone to get back to those summaries and check what we agreed on that purpose, so that we don't get into debates whether there was consensus, whether it was overwhelming support or a shared divergence. We've made that work already. Let's not reopen the discussion. That will facilitate things. Second aspect is we've spent a significant amount of time at the beginning of our work defining what we think should be into Workstream 1 or Workstream 2. And this definition was that Workstream 1 were the measures and accountability mechanisms that would enable the Workstream 2 mechanisms to be implemented even if there was resistance. And I think that's a useful tool to help us draw the line between what we need to address now and what we can address later. And so I really encourage the rapporteurs and draft leaders of all kinds to really use that as much as possible. And of course, to have a productive meeting in Paris, we don't need to have the documents in advance. So so the idea is to have a frozen date, as we've done for the previous meetings, And because it's a face-to-face meeting in Paris, we think that a frozen deadline on Bastille Day on July the 14th is totally appropriate. So we will set this for July the 14th at 23:59 UTC as usual. And those are, I think, the three main items for to keep in mind when preparing. Before going into the draft Paris agenda, are there any comments on these updates? I should note that there is a call for the stress test working party, which is also planned for tomorrow, and where volunteers are more than welcome. But there's also work on the stress test. I see no hand raised, so I'm moving forward to the next item on the agenda, which is the first outline of what the Paris face-to-face meeting will be about. I did share a couple of ideas yesterday on the mailing list, and basically to summarize, the expected outcome is... I see that I have a question from Chris about what we mean by frozen. So the idea is to freeze the documents that are supporting the discussions for the face-to-face meeting 2 to 3 days before the meeting actually starts, so that everyone has an opportunity to review them and avoid last-minute submissions. And enable everyone to start thinking based on a stable document base. So I hope that clarifies the idea of frozen that we've used, which has nothing to do with a specific brand and children entertainment brand in any way. So back to the Paris agenda. So the outcome expected is that we could find common ground on most of the discussions that are still labeled as open, so that we can draft a second set of proposals for Workstream 1 in time for end of July and go to public comment 2 with clear directions. I have circulated a list of items which we believe and we have on our radar as needing some discussions in Paris. That includes the Workstream 1 items out of the new working party, Work Party 3, on the emerging issues. Obviously, the discussions on the community mechanisms, and we'll certainly have a significant session where we will ask any questions to the lawyers, but also a session about how we can find common ground on the way forward on the models, as well as the modalities of the community mechanism. There's still a number of discussions open on the removal of board members or the recall of board members that we need to address. We are aware that we will probably receive contributions from some governments ahead of the face-to-face meeting in Paris. At least that was what was announced in the Buenos Aires communique from the GAC. So that's something we need to prepare on and at least allocate some time to understand these inputs and discuss the related issues. We have a number of refinements to do on the IRP, which are certainly on our agenda. And that's a list of items that we are currently looking at. And our intention so far is to build an agenda based on the topics that we have to address rather than reviewing the draft initial report line by line, so that we can allocate more time to more contentious topics, including maybe one session on day one and one session on day two. And so those are our intentions so far and are open for discussion now. The idea being to provide a more consolidated agenda by next Tuesday, so a few days before the meeting. And that's where I'm calling for your feedback, and I see Cavus' hand is up. Cavus?
And how the removal of the board was is outside, coming out of the discussions. What do you mean by that, removing that? So we don't, we no longer discuss the removal. And when we say removal, we should talk about removal of individual or removal, because people, they call recall for the whole board and removal for individual. Are we talking of removal of individual board that will be out of discussions, or we call, we discuss recall of the entire board is out of discussions, and for each of which, why it came and why we arrived at that decision, how we have discussed that. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. I must not have made myself clear. I think those two items need discussions because they're both the individual board member removal and recall of the whole board. They drew comments in public comment one which were not unanimously supportive, although there was a majority of support. And there were a number of feedback that were asking for refinements or sometimes were not in favor of the measure. So we still need to discuss both of these items. And I would note they are also mentioned in the CWG requirements. So they should be on the agenda. I was listing items that are need to be on our agenda. Davos, do you want to follow up?
Yes, that was a comment on our initial proposal, but now we're reconsidering that initial proposal. We may drop the membership totally. If we drop the membership, then we don't need to drop the call of the board, because that is the only way to do that. If for the budget and for the financial and the strategic plan, we do not follow that procedures anymore and put it on the reconsideration. If the reconsideration is not respected by the board, what else you can do? The only thing you can do, you can remove the board members. So I don't think that you could take that, because in the meantime, you're changing the process. The approach is being changed or is about to be changed. I see some other discussions today on the document and some strange term like the semi-designator or co-designator. So when we change that, comments is no longer be carried forward. And then my question is that, do we have a criteria when we take a comment or not? You said that the majority supported and the minority opposed. Are we taking the minority views or what? Because or we select a particular group of people, when they oppose, we take that one and we forget about the majority which are in favor. So there are many things that are now mixed up. So how you could do that? Because your initial plan is now being changed. So how you could take that? We are not the same path. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. What I take from your point is that, yes, there's a dependency between the discussion on the community model and those specific powers. But I once again, they need to be considered. No one is taking them off the table at this point. But in the agenda, we'll make sure we don't address this question before the community model question. There's no other question. Then I think we can now move to the next agenda item, which is the discussion with the lawyers. And I will move on to Leon for chairing this part of the call. Leon?
Thank you very much, Mathieu. This is Leon Sanchez. And our external lawyers have prepared for us a slide deck in order to review the different models that we are discussing at the moment. It is quite thorough presentation. It's 22 slides, I believe. It has been circulated to the list both in PowerPoint and PDF for your convenience. And I would kindly ask you to let the lawyers speak and do their presentation as a whole, and that we make any questions or comments at the end of their presentation so we don't interrupt them, and because maybe many of the questions that we might have can be answered through the presentation. So the approach would be to let the lawyers speak, and afterwards we will be opening the floor, of course, for any questions or comments with regards to what the lawyers are presenting. So with this, I would turn now to either Holly or Rosemary. I see Holly has her hand raised already. So Holly, could you please take the floor?
So thank you, Leon, and good morning, everyone. We asked the co-chairs for the opportunity to preview with you the work that we've been doing post-Buenos Aires to help prepare for discussions in Paris. We thought that it would be helpful for you to see the slides, have a chance for us to walk through them with you, and then everyone can think about it more, and we can do whatever extra work is needed to have really good, rigorous, and informed discussions in Paris. We can go to the next slide. This presentation reflects our attempt to describe the two new models that were proposed in Buenos Aires, to also discuss some of the primary legal issues that they raise, and then to describe how the models could be implemented under California law. If you go to slide three, we came away from Buenos Aires with a much better understanding of the community and how it works. You know, we've been working with you all for about 4 months, and it's been a steep learning curve in a number of ways. Certainly, these are complex issues that you're facing, both from a group dynamic perspective and really also from a legal perspective. These are not easy, cookie-cutter kinds of issues. In many respects, what you are asking us and what you're thinking about is charting a new direction. It doesn't mean that it can't be supported by law. We think it can, but it means that it's complicated. Now, our role as lawyers is to help understand your goals and concerns and then to help you think about potential pathways and understand the risks associated with those pathways. I've said it before, I want to say it again. We don't have a view on what the right answer is. We don't have a bias in terms of the outcome, other than to help you all come to an informed decision. Now, it was really helpful for us to be with you all in Buenos Aires. We learned a lot about how the community makes decisions. We learned that this community greatly values voluntary cooperation and trust and is generally leery of judicial enforcement. While at the same time, we also heard very pointedly that the current accountability mechanisms in place now are insufficient for a time in which the IANA functions have been transferred from the U.S. government to ICANN. These concerns really underlie the differences of opinion that we're hearing from you all in discussions and seeing in the email interchange. And we think that this is the challenge, is to reconcile these views in some respects. And we think that the models that were put on the table in Buenos Aires really do much to try to bring together some of the concerns, address some of the concerns, and try to find workable compromise. We can go to the next slide. We've tried to provide a graphic of what we call the trust and enforceability continuum and where the models we're discussing fit on this continuum. As you can see, the two new models fit somewhere between what we have on the far left, which is the current voluntary cooperation model, and on the far right, the membership reference model. We can go to the next slide. I want to turn to the models, and I'm rushing through this. You'll all have time to go back to these slides and think about them. But I wanted to turn to our two models because we've got a lot to cover. The empowered SOAC membership model relies on direct participation by SOs and ACs in a potential or actual membership body, but it doesn't require legal personhood, and it would allow opt-in regarding legal status and actual membership at any point in time. The empowered SOAC designator model formalizes and expands on the current roles that the SOs and ACs play in selecting directors and would add on to that powers for the exercise of community power, also without a membership body. I think both of these models respond to concerns that were raised about the lack of enforceability of the current voluntary cooperative model, and both of these respond to the concerns about the avatar concept that was provided in the reference model that was described in the initial proposal. We can go to the next slide. Both of the models have common elements, and I think the primary common elements are that they rely on the SOs and ACs to operate much as they do now, and they rely on, you know, the ICANN board officers and staff to abide by bylaws. So it has sort of the best of a cooperation model, but also with some, both models with significant enforcement underpinning. The enforceability in these models is enhanced through either direct rights or indirect rights around the powers that were described in the initial proposal. And you'll see on this list we've added one additional power. It's the one in brackets. And that's simply the power to reconsider or reject board decisions that relate to the reviews of the IANA functions. And that's because that's one of the CWG dependencies. And we just wanted to make sure that it didn't get lost in the shuffle and was front and center. Now, for designators and for entities that are not legal persons, some of these powers are subject to indirect enforcement, but some are direct. For the membership model, more of these powers are direct. I think in many ways it's the primary difference between the two. We can go to the next slide. If you look at the empowered SOAC membership model, the bylaws would provide that ICANN is a membership body if one or more of the SOs or ACs chooses to become a member. But nobody would be required to become a member, and you could opt in at any time. Now, of course, becoming a member does require legal personhood, but this would be established in a way that whether or not you become a member or decide to participate as a non-member participant, your number of votes, your power, your influence in exercising the community powers would not change. The door, of course, would remain open for SOs and ACs who elect not to become legal persons and members to choose at a future time to do so. So if you go to the next slide, it's our effort to briefly describe some of the legal issues that comes to the top of our minds when we think about this model. And I want to say it at the outset, although we're identifying legal issues, we think a number of these legal issues can be solved for, and you will hear Rosemary a little later in this presentation talk about how this model could be implemented to address as much as possible these kinds of legal concerns. But we think it's important that you understand the legal concerns and therefore what we need to solve for. One concern is, will members and legal persons have greater legal power due to the statutory rights of members and the enforcement power of legal persons? Of course, differential rights can give rise to concerns about capture by one or more groups. Another question that we had, is it possible to even draft valid bylaws that provide participants with the same rights as members? A third issue is, if only a minority of the SOs and ACs become members, can they use statutory rights to disadvantage the others, the participants? And are there ways to protect against the impact of a potentially revolving membership? And finally, are there ways to protect against certain statutory rights of members, like the right to dissolve the corporation and the right to bring derivative suits. We can go to the next slide.
Holly, it's Chris. We missed the whole of that slide, viewing the whole of that slide.
Let's put it back up.
Sorry. We need to get... That's the one we need to.
To slide
that's
eight.
What you were just talking to.
I was talking to that. I'm sorry. I was explaining the concerns about differential rights, about bylaw validity, about the risk of capture, about how do you handle revolving membership, and the concern about member statutory rights, the rights to dissolve a corporation and to bring derivative suit. Can we go to the next slide now? Slide 9. So now let's turn to the empowered SOAC designator model. It would give the S's and AC's specific rights in the bylaws as third-party designators. The bylaws would give each designator the direct power to appoint and remove a certain number of individual directors. The bylaws would also give designators as a group, through the voting in a community mechanism, the powers to reject amendments to standard bylaws upon a community petition process, to review and reject all amendments to fundamental bylaws, and to cause recall of the entire board. The bylaws would also give the designators as a group the indirect but enforceable power to reject the budget and strategy and operating plans and to reject board decisions that relate to the reviews of the IANA functions. Now, what's important to understand is that for these indirect powers, the community would be relying on the ability to trigger community consideration of board recall as the primary enforcement mechanism, which we believe is a very powerful and coercive enforcement mechanism. We can go to the next slide. As with the membership model, the SOAC designator model raises legal issues that we will need to work on through implementation. And again, you will hear from Rosemary on how we believe you can create this empowered designator model that works through these legal issues. Again, you have concerns with differential rights. We're on slide 10. Differential rights, enforceability concerns, the impact of arbitration and standing, and probably most importantly, would there be sufficient enforcement of the designator rights to satisfy the CWG dependencies? If you go to slide 11, you'll see that community powers would work as they're contemplated to work in the reference model. And if you go to slide 12, there's some more detail about the community powers and how they would be enforceable, primarily through encouraging sort of an internal binding review process, the IRP process. And we think that it can be given significant teeth so that it is used as the primary way in which disputes on these kinds of issues are resolved. We can skip over to slide 13. So we're going to turn now to Rosemary, and she's going to present the ideas that the two firms have been working on in the past week and a half about how the model could be implemented and how some of the concerns that have been identified, those legal issues, could be addressed. Now, we need to emphasize that in Buenos Aires, as these models were raised, there wasn't a whole lot of detail around the specifics of how they would work. And so what we're trying to do in this next part of the presentation is really provide some of that detail. We hope that you will agree that the detail we're providing is in keeping with the spirit of these models, but of course, as we've needed to drive into detail, we've had to make some modifications to aid in implementation. So with that note, Rosemary, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Holly. So next slide, please. I wanted to start, that would be slide 14, I wanted to start by just very briefly reminding everyone that what we have now is a model where the board has full control over ICANN, subject to the mission statement in the Articles of Incorporation and Bylaws, and a duty to act in ICANN's best interests. We do have the provision in the bylaws that certain SOs and ACs and the nominating committee appoint directors, but not the power to remove them, at least not clearly. And so the powers to amend the articles and bylaws are solely in the hands of the board. Next slide, please. I didn't want to spend too much time on what we have already. I think you know it better than we do. So as we turned to implementation, we realized that one of the problems that was mentioned in the legal question slide that Holly discussed earlier with the membership model was that we would be trying to draft a membership structure, a legal type of corporation, with a period where there might well be, and maybe even an extended period, no members. And under corporate law, that was going to create problems because we would be giving powers that the law wouldn't allow us to give except to members, and we wouldn't have any. So the more we thought about it, we realized that, in fact, both models start with a voluntary compliance phase, and that voluntary compliance phase looks very, very much alike. And, in fact, everything in the box on this page, bylaws enhancement, applies to both. And then at the bottom, you see that there's a little bit of difference between going to a designator model versus going to a membership model. And when I say going to, we have everything in place for the membership model when we put this whole thing in place. And then, essentially, at some point, there's a trigger, as you can see at the bottom where it talks about under specified trigger conditions, the membership structure would spring into action. And prior to that, both models are essentially relying on the rights that can be given to non-members, which is kind of like saying designators, in order to enhance the rights for the SOs and ACs, strengthen the IRP, put in place the community voting mechanism that has been discussed, and that was on one of Holly's earlier slides. And so you can see here the list of things that would be done. We would add the right to remove directors that the SOs and ACs now maybe have, but we want to make sure they have, clearly stated in the bylaws. We would give the power to veto amendments to articles and bylaws to the participants in the community. Other than that, the entities would be able to maintain their current forms, whether or not they are legal persons. We believe at least one of these entities, of these groups, is a legal person already, for example. And then the bylaws would add all the detail of the community mechanism, the voting allocation, et cetera. As I said, it would strengthen the internally binding IRP process and channel disputes into that process and expressly not require that groups be persons in order to initiate an IRP or participate in an IRP, although obviously if you ever get to the point of judicial enforcement outside of ICANN, you would need a person at that point. We would also want to consider, this is one example here, whether the community should also be given other rights, such as rights that are typically given to members and could be given to non-members, like the inspection of records. And there might be others that we would want to kind of carefully go through. In this phase, both models would have a springing resignation letter that each director would sign as part of becoming a director that would have triggers set forth in the letter that says, I resign if any of the following happen. That letter would be held by, not by the director, but by ICANN, some representative of ICANN. And one of the triggers would be a no-confidence vote by the community mechanism in the event that the board fails to give the community the seven powers that the bylaws say the community is supposed to have. Designators, as sort of a belt and suspenders approach, designators would also be required by the bylaws and maybe even by contract, we want to think that through more, to recall all the directors if the community mechanism so directs, and only if the community mechanism so directs. So you don't have, you could have this, we haven't drafted it yet, so you have some detailed decisions to make down the road. But the idea is that the designators have some agreement about when they will exercise their right to recall directors individually or their obligation to recall them all at once. We did not think through at this point, and I don't think it's our job to think it through, but we believe that the community will need to think through the nominating committee's status and role through all this, whether you want to treat it just the way all the other SOs and ACs are treated or whether it gets differential treatment because it's not the same kind of body as they are. And then as I noted at the bottom there, there's a difference. If it's the designator model, the empowered SOAC designator model, then any of the SOs and ACs could opt at any time. If it's not a legal person, it could opt to become a legal person. And if it already is a legal person, it could opt to enhance its ability. It could opt to enforce powers given in the enhanced bylaws. And on the other hand, if we're in the membership version of this, again, the SOs and ACs could opt at any time to become legal persons, or if they already are, they would have that ability to enforce. And if trigger conditions were met, and I'll get to those on the next slide, probably slide 17, then ICANN would be converted to a membership structure, and various other changes would happen because of that. So don't go to slide 17 yet. I was just referring to that. Now we want to be on slide 16, please. Thank you. So this slide looks at details a little bit more what happens in those two little statements that were at the bottom of the prior slide. So first of all, if we look at the empowered SOAC designator model, what happens, again, as I said earlier, each SO or AC can determine at any time that it wants to become a legal person in order to be able to enforce rights, unless it already is one. And it gets to decide what type of legal entity to become. That's not going to necessarily, not everyone has to do the same thing. Once they have legal personhood, or if they already have legal personhood, they have the ability to seek enforcement in court to of binding IRP decisions or claims that they have that they want to enforce that arose after their personhood existed. So you're not going to be able to go back forever and say something that happened before we became a person, we now want to enforce. But assuming that the IRP decision is something that you would become a person at the time the decision was issued, then you'd be able to enforce it. And there would be no other changes. Some of the, as Holly said earlier, these models were modified by us in order to, I think the phrase that was used in Buenos Aires was, drive them as far as we could drive them. Push them out as far as possible to do what you wanted to do. But that doesn't mean that we were able to get 100% of everything. I think any choice of model is going to involve trade-offs. And so while we addressed all we could within the way the legal framework works, there were still some things that remained, and that's what this right-hand column talks about. Those SOs and ACs that either cannot or won't become legal persons are just not going to be able to ultimately enforce their rights. On the other hand, other SOs and ACs that do have personhood would be able to enforce, so there are certain kinds of enforcement issues where you don't need everyone to be able to enforce. Anyone could do it. And then if it's to do with directors that an SO or AC wanted to appoint, and there was some problem with recognition of that new director, then that director would have the standing to sue. And because it's not a membership structure, the SOs and ACs cannot have the reserved powers that can only be given to members to be able to reverse board decisions. Like approving the budget strategy and operating plan or implementing review panel recommendations. But there would be the indirect enforcement that Holly mentioned, just not direct enforcement. If we then turn to the empowered SOAC membership model, staying on slide 16, again, each SOAC determines for itself when and whether and what type of legal entity to become, and that could include selecting an individual to be the member. And then this is the trigger, and this is one of the things that we had to do to solve some of the big concerns we had with how this model would work otherwise. Rather than what the community proposed in Buenos Aires, rather than having it become a membership organization as soon as any one member was willing to become a member, we thought that something like a majority, you could obviously set this higher than a majority, or even lower than a majority, but we picked that as a sample of how we think this would work. A majority of those SOs and ACs decide both to become legal persons and to become members, then we would flip ICANN into membership status as a membership organization with members and all the statutory rights. And that includes the right to reverse board decisions on the budget, the strategic plan, and the direct right to veto bylaw amendments. And members have standing by law. So some of the remaining problems and complications with the as far as we could drive the empowered SOAC membership model is that we couldn't see a way to avoid drafting in extensive future provisions that would take full advantage of all of the membership provisions in the statute. We don't think that you want to just leave it to the default regulation of the statute, because from what we understand, there's a lot of areas where if you become a membership organization, you would not want the statutory defaults. So we'd need to really create that full set of membership bylaws that would become activated on a trigger. And because once, if it were triggered, those entities that had chosen to become persons and members would suddenly hold all that member power. That is the nature of a membership organization. And that would put the non-member SOACs, the ones either that couldn't or wouldn't become persons or chose not to become members, would be at a disadvantage. We looked at the concern regarding derivative suits that members are given the statutory right to bring, and it's unclear at this point how we would be able to really robustly limit that ability for members to essentially end run the process that you want all suits to have to go through. And because members have so much power over an organization, there is a risk that members could capture the organization, if there were very few members. As I said, that's why we put in the trigger to say at least you have a majority. It's the power to dissolve the corporation, which is quite a lot of power if you only have one member. And that we aren't clear that because of the limitation on voting agreements among members, we aren't sure that exactly how we would limit that. We certainly haven't decided we can't, but that is something we would still need to work on. So that's the overview of a more granular version, a more tied into the legal framework version. The next two slides, starting with slide 17, which you can turn to now, please. What we've tried to do here is the first column lists the various powers that the community has been discussing and includes the CWG dependency, last one on the next slide, which you don't need to go to yet. It's just there. So we've got all that same list of powers from the earlier slide. And then the first column after the list of powers is how that power would be exercised and possibility to enforce it. When you are in that first phase, the voluntary cooperative phase, the phase that's closest to where you are right now, which we called quasi-designator, but it would be stronger than the where you are now. So that's what it looks like. That first column would apply whether we're in the membership model or the designator model. And I'm not going to go through all these powers, by the way. I'm going to let you know that this is here and how it's structured and explain it a little, but then you're going to get to look at it later over time. Then you would either move, if you want the membership model, then you should look at the middle of the three columns that's labeled enforcement phase, empowered members. And it talks there about a little more of the detail of how we would attempt to implement that right. And then the last column is for the designator version, the designator model, and how it would look there. And you'll see very frequently in that last column that the first thing is the same mechanism as in the voluntary phase. What that reflects is that moving from the first column to the third column is not a big change. It's just someone decides to start enforcing their powers by becoming a person and then exercising rights under the bylaws as a person. Whereas the difference between the column that's pre-enforcement phase, the voluntary phase, and the membership, it never says same mechanism as voluntary phase. And the reason is the whole point of converting into membership status is to take full advantage of all the powers that members have under statute. And so we're shifting away from a voluntary model and really focusing on a membership model and that whole set of membership bylaws provisions that I mentioned. So I think that's all I'm going to say for now, both in the interest of time and making sure we have enough time for questions. But obviously, if there's a particular power that you're interested in or you just want to study this whole thing, I think it will give you a lot more information about how we envision the mechanics of each model working at each point in time, either before we have a membership model and before anyone's trying to enforce when we're really purely voluntary versus once we're in a more of an enforcement phase. Holly, I'll turn it back to you for the last couple slides.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rosemary. And we don't really need to go over the next couple slides. They're really just reminders of, you know, things we already know, some of the guiding principles that were set out early on in the proposal with respect to, you know, where we can keep it closer to what we already have, that there's a value in that. We also put down sort of the kinds of considerations that were spoken of in Buenos Aires of the last couple slides. If you go to the next slide, that in the appendix slide, keep going. I think it's that slide. We have not populated this. You'll see we did not check any boxes. We think this is the kind of thing that you may want to think about and go through in Paris. And there's another slide, slide 22, takes the factors that we all considered in Friday when we had, in Buenos Aires, when we had the lengthy discussion of the various models that had been put on the table at that point. These are just the kinds of ways in which you were analyzing those proposals. And again, we thought, as a reminder, you may want to at some point come back to this and look and talk about how each of these potential models does under these different criteria. That being said, look, we know we've just provided a huge amount of information. And the reason that we had asked for the opportunity to present this in a fairly direct and seamless way was to put it out there ahead of Paris, to give you the slides ahead of Paris. As you'll note in the notes view of the slide, there are links and references to the legal memos we've provided you in advance so that you can also look at that material if you have questions. And that way people can come to Paris with sort of a common baseline around information on these models so that they can be discussed in much greater detail. And I thank you for your forbearance in giving us the time to do this today. We look forward to addressing questions both here if people are ready to have questions or in Paris when we see you next week. And with that, Leon, I'm going to pass it back to you.
Thank you very much, Holly. Thank you very much, Rosemary. This has been a most productive presentation, I think, and I see some comments in the chat box already endorsing this too. I have taken note of a couple of questions in the chat box. I see that the people that raised those questions have already their hands up, so I, of course, turn to the queue. And first on the queue, I have Malcolm Huddy. So, Malcolm, could you please take the floor?
Thank you. And first, can I say thank you to Holly and to Rosemary for this very comprehensive presentation, which I'm sure everyone will find extremely useful. The comment that I would make actually goes back to the original scope. Right at the beginning, in the slide 2, the overview, it says that you took as your starting point seeking to address the concerns raised as to the impact of the various models for implementing Section 5 of the CCWG's initial draft proposal, the community powers. I'm afraid that in asking you to take that as your starting point, we have erred. We should have asked you, I believe, to consider how the two models will impact on the whole proposal, not just Section 5 of the proposal. Section 3 of the proposal on the principles, the mission and core values and so forth, and the Section 4 on the appeals mechanisms, which includes the crucial IRP on which so much of our proposal rests, are also very important, and we need to understand the impact of or to what extent the two different models can deliver on those elements of the proposal, as well as on how they can deliver Section 5. Now, I noticed that that you do make a brief passing reference to a difference between the two. On slide 16, under the empowered SOAC designator model, under problems and complications, you say that the designator model would not have the reserve powers of members to reverse board opinions, such as to require the implementation of an IRP decision. So I think that would be something that would be an important thing to pull out. But because the scope has been focused on only Section 5 and not also Section 4 and Section 3, that has rather been buried in the detail. Now, your slides at the end, slides 17 and 18, go in deep of the differences between these models. But again, those community powers in Section 5, plus the one that you've added from the CWG, but without adding the consideration of how we would implement the difference and the impact on the implementation of, for example, the IRP. So that bit that you call out in slide 16, I think would have given greater prominence to if you'd been asked to set a broader scope, and I think it's important to draw that out. So I wonder if it would be possible, before you present this in Paris, to slightly recast this with that scope so as to draw that out more clearly. Thank you.
Leon, this is
thank you very much for that, Malcolm. Yes, Holly, I was going to turn back to you, so yes, do please.
So, Malcolm, those are great points. Absolutely. And I want to assure you that we considered those issues as well, but in the interest of time, we believe the issues that are posed by the sections you cited are far more straightforward, and they are not as impacted by the differences in these models. Hence, our focus has been on the more difficult areas. But we absolutely agree that any of this needs to be looked at ultimately, holistically, And so there was no intent to ignore those issues. Rather, we were focusing on the things that we are struggling with the most. And certainly in Paris, we can add some more detail around how those other issues are impacted. But again, I want to assure you that we are well aware of that. We have done this whole project for the last week and a half with the initial draft proposal at our right hand, thumbing through it to make sure that we understand how things interrelate. But thank you for that, Malcolm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malcolm and Holly. Next in the queue, I have Tijani. We still have a lot of people in the queue and a lot of questions, so if you can keep it as concrete as possible, it will be much appreciated. So, Tijani, could you please take the floor? Tijani, you might be on mute.
Do you hear me? Do you hear me?
We do hear you now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Leon. Tijani speaking. First of all, I'd like to thank the legal team for the work done and for this more or less comprehensive presentation. I would like to ask if the escalation is not decided by the community, the whole community, as described, does that prevent any member to have the legal status and to do the enforcement he wants? Second question, I heard about a third model. Is it possible to give us an overview of it? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tijani. Holly or Rosemary, would you want to answer those questions?
I'm going to let Rosemary answer the first part of that question. I just wanted to talk about this notion of a third model. You know, we as lawyers take our direction from our client, and one of the challenges here is that we don't yet have a client that's quite speaking with one voice as we're trying to understand goals. But we're learning, and we're also learning about the group's way of interacting and working, and we're trying to be very respectful of that. We do have an idea that we think it's worth exploring, and that could simplify some things, but unless the community, the group asks us to dig down and study it and provide it detail around it to you, we thought it was both, you know, presumptuous and premature of us to offer it up. So with that being said, if the group asks us to provide more information about another way, and we don't see it as a separate model, really. We see it as a slight modification, if you will, to the two current models that you're talking about, and it really has to do with, you know, when we talk about legal personhood, where do we want to focus that? Both models that we're talking about now think about legal personhood as being something that SOs and ACs might wish to have to improve their enforceability, to become members, to have greater assurance around how they exercise rights. The other option that you may want to consider at some point in time is not worrying about SOs and ACs ever having any kind of legal personhood, but thinking about the community having legal personhood. And we think it's a fairly simple thing to do. But I will just leave it there for now.
Thank you very much, Holly. Next in the queue, I have Robin.
Hi, this is Robin. Can you hear me?
Yes, we do listen to you.
Can you hear me okay? Okay. All right, so I've got a question, and thanks so much to the lawyers for these really wise and comprehensive overview. But I've got a question. The way the Empowered Designator model is described in these slides is that it must be requiring a right of rejection with respect to the budget and the strategic plan. And I'm wondering, to what extent can we build out a pre-approval right so we don't have to get to needing to reject? ultimately, but I'll be on the same page before we get to a final decision. So, for example, the way GTLD policy is made, it's in ICANN's bylaws that the process is it goes through the bottom-up working groups, and then it goes to the GNSO Council where it gets approved, and then it goes to the board where it gets approved. And this is a process that's in ICANN's bylaws right now. And so I'm wondering, to what extent can we create some sort of similar pre-approval right on those two issues that are currently described as needing a rejection right? Because I think we have another option here, or maybe we don't, but I'd like to at least explore that a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. Holly or Rosemary?
This is Holly. I can't think of a reason why you couldn't have some kind of pre-approval right. But we were simply taking the budgetary review and rejection as described from the initial proposal. We weren't trying to rethink all of the ways in which you've described the powers to date that you want. To us, we were sort of taking it that you described the powers the way that you were most interested in asserting them. So to us, that's, you know, if you all want to look at that, we're happy to look at that. But to us, that was sort of a change that wasn't on the table for us to start delving into.
Thank you very much, Holly. I have next on the queue, James Scannon.
Hi, it's James. So first of all, thanks to Holly and Rosemary. It's a really great overview of the various things that are going on at the moment. It was very helpful. So first of all, I think there's been a lot pressed in the possibility of the third model that the council have came up with independently on their own thinking. I'm not sure what way it works, if the members have to put a formal call to the chairs for that to be. But if there's anything that we can do here while we are now, I think that we need to put it to them formally that we would like them to look into it as they're sort of interested across the community from it. In the interest of time, I have some questions, and I've been talking with some people since Buenos Aires about various things that are going on around models, and a couple of us have actually come up with a list of a couple of questions, both for the lawyers, but also questions that we think the community needs to answer ourselves. But in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through them now. What we'll do is I'll send them to the list after this call. But at a high level, I'll set out three themes that I think people should be thinking about. And they're not exclusive. There's definitely more than just these. But so the balance of powers between the SOs and the ACs is a very important point that we need to look inside our own communities and see what our levels of risk and acceptability around the balance of power is. And for each SO and AC on their future work and how they're going to work going forward. And also, obviously, the most important for many of us is the enforceability. Where our boundaries lie on enforceability. Are we happy with a fully voluntary enforceability model? Do we need to have that one step up to the recall of board members or the whole board for enforceability? Or do ultimately we feel that we need a full legal jurisdictional enforceability mechanism, and that's something that everybody needs to have a strong think about as we go through the models, particularly in Paris. But because there's a good few questions and they are more detailed, what I'll do is after the call we'll send the list, the set of questions.
Thank you very much, James. Those are indeed good questions, and I think that many of those questions are need to be answered by us as a group. So yes, it would be very helpful if you could send this to the list so we can feed the discussion. And I don't know, Holly or Rosemary, do you have anything to add to James' questions?
I don't have anything. This is Holly. I don't have anything to add. Perhaps Rosemary, I don't know if you have a comment. We do look forward, James, very much to receiving the list of questions, and we'll certainly do whatever we can between now and Paris to try to provide further clarity.
I would just add that what I think James has identified, and I think you also, Leon, indicated, is that how you choose between these models, this is something Holly said at the beginning, we're not prejudging what level of enforceability you need. It took us a while to understand that when you talked about having a right, you didn't necessarily attach to it the way a lawyer in America does, ultimate enforceability, meaning you can go to court and get that right enforced, and that anything short of that wasn't really a real right because it's not enforceable. And now we realize that that's not how you think about it, and that there are, for you, there's levels of enforceability, and you can have a right that maybe relies on almost no ability to enforce it, but really relies heavily on that voluntary cooperation that's worked for you for so long, but in the presence of the NTIA. And so I think that is for the community, for CCWG, and then the community, I guess, to resolve, not for the lawyers. We're trying to make it clear how enforcement would look, what level of enforcement you could get for each of the rights, what the mechanism would be, and how far it would take you. And then you all have to do the balancing and decide on balance where you want to be with enforceability.
Thank you very much, Holly and Rosemary. Ms. McHugh, I have Jonathan. Jonathan?
Thanks. Jonathan Zook for the transcript. Thanks again for this presentation. I'm a little bit reminded of the old Mark Twain saying that I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have enough time. And so a part of me would really love to see the two-slide version of this that basically looks at the concerns that have been raised. And I started, some of this is at the end of the presentation. I'm just a little worried they're a little too binary the way that it's laid out there. But as you just said, the community is a little bit mixed about how important enforcement is. But if there was a way to reduce this down to a question of preferences as opposed to a question of fact, which we find ourselves completely, we will go into several meetings after this one and completely disagree about what it is we just heard today. And I'm wondering if there's some way to say, look, this particular model has a greater likelihood of X happening that some people express concern about. The cost of eliminating that risk is Y, which others have expressed concern about, so that people can really focus on what their concerns and preferences are and less on the details of each of these plans. I mean, that's my, I guess I would love to reduce this to a few questions about priorities that the community can then grapple with in an ideological way as opposed to constantly being mired in disagreeing about the facts of these different proposals. Thanks.
Thanks, Jonathan. Any reaction?
I'd like to react to that. I agree that there's, you know, so you're seeing in part sort of the sausage being made. The length of the slides is in part a measure of our effort to work through these, what are, as I said, these are very complex issues. This is not simple stuff. And often there's not a clear legal answer, and we're trying to extrapolate how we think the law would apply if a particular issue was raised. I do think, I like your idea of saying, well, what are the questions now that we need to focus on to help us focus our thinking and our discussion? And if you'd like, Rosemary and I could come up with a list of maybe 3 or 4 or 5 questions designed to try to guide further discussion, or maybe to test, you know, where the group is that we could use in Paris. But well taken a set of comments and critique around this presentation. Appreciated. Thank you.
And again, it's not a critique. It's just
thank you very much, Holly.
Advantages and disadvantages, or pros and cons, or something like that. I think might guide our conversations less into the realm of disputing what was said and more about what various people believe are the priorities. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I will now close the queue after Chris is paid so we can have further discussion with the third model. And next on the queue, I have Caboose.
Yes, without any qualification or presentation, I'm totally disappointed. We come back in April. At the beginning of this process, the lawyers pushed for membership, and today they're pushing for membership. They present three things. At the end, they come that if you want to have something works, go to the membership. So I don't think that anything new in this presentation. This presentation was totally passive. We should have a slide by a slide asking the people to comment, but it did not allow that. We have 40 minutes of presentations, unilateral, and there was no room for the people to talk. When we said something in the chat, there were a few people that said, yo, it's extremely useful. We have learned a lot. We are not a school boys. We are not coming here to learn something. We are going to have something which works. So I'm very sorry, this is not useful at all. And I interrupted the phone, and I cannot listen anymore to this discussion because it is totally counterproductive. It's totally counterproductive. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caruso. So no questions to the lawyer, to the lawyers on your side. Next on the queue, I have to Jenny. But first, would the lawyers want to react to Caruso's comments?
I don't have any reaction.
Okay, thank you. And if there's anyone to blame for asking the lawyers not to be interrupted, it's certainly me, so I take the blame on that. Tijani, you're next. So
yes, thank you, Leon. Leon, I am sorry, but perhaps my first question wasn't answered, or perhaps I didn't hear it. I asked about if there is not a community decision about the escalation, does that prevent any member, and I understood it does not, any member to or any SONDC to become a legal person and to do the enforcement he wants.
Thank you very much, Tijani. Holly or Rosemary, could you please...
Sure.
This is
Rosemary. I think that there is an issue for us with the membership model. One of the, if you look on slide 16, where we talk about the membership model, the bottom half of the slide 16, it talks about members being able to bring derivative suits beyond suits anticipated to enforce the IRP, and it's not clear yet how strongly we'll be able to limit that. So we're having some trouble dealing with ways to prevent a single member from being able to exercise member statutory rights. And the next point, bullet below that, is related to that. That's why we have suggested that you would delay conversion to membership status, because it gives so much power to those who are members compared to those who are not. Now, if everyone becomes a member, we will have less concerns with the second bullet, let me number them correctly. The fourth bullet in that column. Could I have slide 16 so people can see what I'm talking about, please? The fourth bullet under problems and complications of the membership model, we can reduce by delaying membership status, conferring true membership status, until there's at least a majority or some other threshold of groups that are willing to become members. What our concern was that if one person can trigger membership status, then they have all the powers of a member if no one else chooses to join at that point. But the third bullet in that column, the one about being able to bring suits, for example, it's difficult because these are rights given to members in the statute. we are not yet sure how completely we could constrain that power. We believe that we can largely channel the internal process toward the IRP. In fact, we should be able to do that with respect to almost everything. But should someone decide to go around it, we're still working on how we would constrain that.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. Thank you very much, Rosemary. I hope that answers Jen's question. If not, we can, of course, continue this offline. Mm-hmm.
Can I add one more thing, please, Leon?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. I think what we're seeing is that the membership model unquestionably gives the community the strongest amount of control or ability to control the board, and that's the way that the statute is drafted, which is members can override board decisions, for example. And there's no one else who can under the statute. So when you hear us, if that is your priority, which I'm not saying it is or should be, but if that is your priority, that will drive you to the membership model. It is both the strength and the weakness of the membership model, because all that power goes to whoever is a member and doesn't go to anyone who's not a member. And so the designator model, in my mind, and I'm not supporting or trying to say which one you should pick, but as a legal matter, the designator model avoids some of that extreme power in the membership, but you might think that that extreme power is exactly what you need and exactly what you should have, and I'm not saying it's not. But what the designator model then has is the weakness of not being the membership model, which is there's some things you can't force the board directly to do, although what I think we have come up with is some very strong, very heavy sticks that the community would hold to allow the community to not just get the board's attention, but really make what they want to have happen. It's just indirect because it's not membership. I think that responds in part perhaps to maybe Kavush's comments as well, that if what you think is that you need the most power you can have, then it's pretty clear that you have to go to some form of membership model. And actually the third model that we were talking about, having the community be the member rather than a series of members that are the different components of the community, is in part of our thinking as a way to address this, putting so much power in the hands of just those who are members versus those who are not.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. We have two more people in the queue, and after that we will jump to elaborating on the third option. So if you could please keep your interventions short, that would be very useful. Next on the queue, I have Izumi. Izumi, could you please take the floor? Izumi, you might be on mute. We can't listen to you, Izumi. I will go to Robin, and then we'll come back to you.
Hi, this is Robin. Can you hear me?
We do listen to you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So I have a question about derivative lawsuits under the membership model, and this is something we haven't explored very much, but I think we really should know what we might be getting into. I noted earlier in the presentation the lawyer said they didn't think they would be able to limit a member's ability to file derivative lawsuits. Please correct me if I got that wrong. So I'm wondering, what does that really mean on a practical level for ICANN and for the community, the threats of derivative lawsuits? Are we going to have a situation where board members or staff or members of the community in general could be under threat of litigation if decisions are made that that they don't like. I really don't know the answer to that question, but I think we need to have some discussion about what it could mean. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. Holly?
So, great question, Robin, and I think it's something that we can also explore in more detail in Paris if you'd like, but I'll speak to it a little bit here. So, derivative litigation is something that's available to a member to say that I'm, because the board is not taking action vis-a-vis a potential claim that it has on behalf of the corporation, I, as a member, am going to step into those shoes and bring an action on behalf of the corporation. That's why it's called derivative. It's really an action by the corporation, but the member has the right to bring it. The kinds of suits that are typically brought as derivative actions or actions are suits that involve a claim that a board is somehow acting inappropriately vis-a-vis the bylaws, vis-a-vis fiduciary duties, or that a subset of directors, one or more directors, is acting in breach of fiduciary duties. And derivative actions are where the corporation has, meaning the board itself, has really declined to bring that action, and so a member is forcing that action. There is a risk that, you know, what we haven't yet been able to nail down with any certainty is whether we could have the bylaws or contracts, really bylaws, provide that these kinds of inter-corporate disputes must be brought through an IRP binding arbitration mechanism. There's some case law in Maryland that suggests that you can have binding bylaws that require arbitration, but it's not fully clear in many states, and there's some significant question in states like Delaware around whether that's true. I believe California is just at the moment silent. So we could attempt to draft an IRP and a bylaw that says you must use the IRP for intercompany disputes. The question is whether a member would be successful in going to court and saying, my statutory rights are much more powerful than this kind of bylaw provision, and trump the bylaw provision. And we just don't know how a court will decide that. So it's an issue that we need to raise so that you're aware of the potential risk. I think to the extent that the community really does value sort of voluntary cooperation and can look at the IRP as something that we think most of the SOs and ACs, who will be the members, would use if they had faith that the board would feel bound to it, then I think some of the risk around derivative suits goes away. But the difficulty comes when you get in a severe dispute, there is a risk that someone's going to try to run right to court. And I don't know that we can prevent that for members with any great surety. So with
thank
that,
you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Holly.
No, that's fine, Leon. I was through.
Thank you. Thank you, Holly. We have a question from Izumi Okutami with regards to how exactly does the community personhood works. So if you could please provide us some feedback on that, Holly or Rosemary, would
So I'll start out, and then if Rosemary, if you'll chime in, because I know that both of our firms have been thinking about it a little bit, but we haven't sort of gone full bore on it because we've been waiting an instruction before we did that. The notion here is a fairly simple one, which could work with either in any of the kinds of powers we're talking about, and enforcement mechanisms. This could work. What you would do is all of the SOs and ACs would participate in this community mechanism that we've been talking about, meaning a place where the votes come together and are given effect. And instead of having SOs and ACs be legal persons for enforcement purposes or for membership purposes, you would make that body the legal person that would be the sole member of ICANN. It would function just exactly as you've been contemplating the community mechanism would function. It's not an avatar. It doesn't need a set of
officers and whatnot, whatever the vote of the community is, would be the vote of the single member in regards to the powers with respect to ICANN. And so we think it could be a very simple mechanism to give the enforcement. One of the lovely things about it is it means, as to the statutory powers that come with membership, those could only be exercised if a majority of the SOs and ACs, through their voting powers, decided through the community mechanism that they should be exercised. So the only member that could bring a derivative suit would be this sole member, which would be a function of a vote among the SOs and ACs, and therefore it's very unlikely that they would ever decide to bring a derivative action. The same with respect to issues like dissolution. So it's a fairly simplified taking of the empowered SOAC membership model and saying, instead of worrying about membership for individual SOs and ACs and worrying about legal personhood, we just pump it up a level. We think we could provide it through the bylaws. There wouldn't be a lot of formal, other kinds of formal documentation. The bylaws would state that the community mechanism is to be recognized as a legal person. And, you know, I think that there are details to work out, but that's the basic construct. Thank you. Rosemary, do you want to weigh in?
Sure. I think you did a fine job, Holly. So I will leave that with respect to the single member model, the third model. I'll leave it at that. I think Izumi may have been asking about legal personhood. I'm not sure if she meant only for the entire community in the single member model, but maybe a little more detail about what it would take for one SO or one AC to decide, okay, now we need to enforce a right, we see it coming down the road, we want to be a person. It would be a resolution of the group saying we want to associate to hold this right under the bylaws. And we would draft the bylaws in such a way that such a resolution would be sufficient, we believe, to confer legal personhood. What kind of legal person is it? I'm not trying to hide the ball. It would be, because that's the default when you're not a corporation and you're not a partnership and you're not a legal limited liability company and you're not any, you know, limited liability partnership or any of the other forms we have, the last remaining form is an unincorporated association. But it's not the unincorporated association that was referred to as an avatar that's separate from the SOAC. It's the SO or AC itself saying, we are going to have the level of intent to join together for a purpose that is sufficient to confer legal personhood status on us under these bylaws.
Thank you very much, Holly and Rosemary, for this. I see that there are many questions being raised in the chat box already, so I think it would be good to address those questions as well. I do have Christmas Payne on the queue and Caboose, so I would go to Chris and Caboose and then would jump back to the questions in the chat box, if you allow me. So, Chris, could you please take the floor?
Thank you, Leon, and Rosemary and Holly, thanks for explaining that. I think it's really interesting. All I wanted to do was to ask you if you could perhaps provide us with, between now and Paris, maybe just a sort of overview of how you think it might work and whether you think it butts up against some of the same problems that exist with the membership model generally, or whether you think some of those problems don't exist with being a single member. I quite like the concept of us having sort of like a group. I'm just a little wary about whether we are solving the issue of how people can join that group if they need to be legal persons. But I'm not dismissing it at all, and I would really appreciate it if you could just maybe do a sort of brief analysis of how it meets some of the criteria and maybe has problems with other ones.
Thank you very much, Chris. I don't know if that needs any answer from Holly and Rosemary. I think they will be providing us with this information for sure. So next I have Caboose. Caboose, could you please say
yes, John, I think, first of all, you three, chair and co-chair, are fully responsible to assume your responsibility ordering all these works. This is number one, because many people, they don't agree. First of all, the SO and AC, they are not fully representing the entire community, but we had no alternative accepting those seven. Among those seven, two of them are out, and there will be more probability that only remain one single member if that famous so-called membership go ahead. And we have seen a lot of problems that if one single member is authoritative for the entire process. So we are working totally on theory, but not on practice. And we producing or manufacturing a product that we cannot sell it, unfortunately. We should be quite clear when we have the document in Paris to be understood by the people that we are not going back to the thing that was not clear. So that is the situation. We should be quite clear to the community that we do not push them, that is that the only possible way is membership. We have to see what is the more practical, what is more pragmatic, and what is workable. And not on the theory, but not on idealistic, going to the realistic. So this is the situation. Unfortunately, we have not made any progress at all. We just expand whatever we had. We express that in a different way, but exactly the same idea, and we are talking of membership model. I repeat that there is no necessity that for the budget and for the strategic plan, we go to empower the community to reject that. With reconsideration, it is possible to do that. If the reconsideration doesn't work, you have the possibility to remove board member. So we have to simplify the matter and not push the community for something which doesn't work. Maybe you don't listen, that's all, but we think that there would be maybe even not any single membership at all. I see only one of the seven community could be a candidate for membership, at least, and not at least maximum one, but that one I'm not sure that will remain. So I don't think that this membership would have any client. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caboose. We do listen, but we are also obliged to listen to everyone. So one of the people that we're listening now is NTIA Secretary Larry Strickland, and he clearly stated that we must explore all models available. And as far as we can tell, we are doing this exercise by coming back not only to the membership model, but to the designer model, and the lawyers will be speaking now on a third option, and no one is deciding anything at this call, of course. We should be looking into the different models back in Paris, and hopefully then we will be able to call for consensus within the group, and this, of course, implies that the whole group will be taking part of the decision and not only a couple of persons. So your comments are very well taken into account, and we will continue to, of course, evaluate the different models that we are obliged to by our charter and fulfilling the petitions by the NTIA as well. So now I will go to the questions in the chat box. I see a question from Robin on how do we protect minority rights under this model that was being described. So if could you please, Holly or Rosemary, answer to that question with regards to minority rights in this model that was just explained to us.
So I think the issue of minority rights comes up under any model. I'm not quite sure that I see any differential vis-a-vis the models, although some of the models provide opportunity for actual capture by a minority in certain circumstances. One of the things that I know that you've been talking about already vis-a-vis protecting minority rights is thinking about in what circumstances do you need some kind of supermajority voting threshold for key decisions. Another way in which minority rights can be given voice is through some kinds of IRP mechanisms. I think we need to do more work on that under any of the models to make sure that we understand what minority rights we're seeking to protect and how they're being protected. It's a very good issue, and I don't think we've really addressed it in any of the models, including the reference model that's been put out in the initial proposal, or, quite frankly, in the current voluntary cooperation model. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Holly. I see Rosemary's hand is up. Rosemary?
Yes, so the concept of the single-member model is that we move the membership status from the individual SOs and ACs that choose to become members, and we move it up to the whole community, as Holly described. And some of the comments I'm seeing on the chat go directly to what I was saying earlier about when you compare the designator model and the membership model and where the power is, the membership model gives power to the members. And it gives it to each member and to the member collectively. So now, you know, that's comparing it to the designator model. The membership model has more power in individual members and in the membership than we can give to designators. Now when we look at comparing the lower level membership to the single member model, we see the exact same thing happening, which is that the power is no longer, if we move up to having the whole community be the member, the individual components of the community just don't have those powers anymore because they've now been put into the collective. And that is, again, both what you might like or dislike about the single member model. You might like, for example, that now we don't have to worry about one SO or one AC holding tons of power because it's not a member. It will have no member rights. It may have other rights they can give in the bylaws, but it won't have the statutory rights of members, which we were so worried about. So you might like that the power has been raised, you know, it's now at that single member level and not in all the individual groups. But you might also not like that because you might have liked that one member could have a right to inspect documents and not have to worry about any other members agreeing with it. Now you don't have that because you're not a member anymore at that level. The membership is the single body. So I think some of the it is good that the questions that I'm seeing asked about these really go to the heart of each of them and their pros and cons. And you asked us to push the two models as far as we could toward what we understood you wanted. But that doesn't mean we reached it. As I said earlier, all these models are going to involve trade-offs, and it depends on what you want to trade off. And by you guys have to come to some kind of consensus because not any one of you gets to decide what the right trade-off is. You have to somehow agree as a group which of the models provides the best trade-off. But you are identifying in your discussions of them, which I hope means that we've done a modestly okay job of describing them so far, and we will try and do better for Paris with more time and with maybe a third model on the table. But you are getting what the differences are between the models and what they offer and don't offer in each of them.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. I have two more hands raised. I have Tijani and Matthew, so I will turn to Tijani. Tijani, could you please take the floor?
Thank you. thank you, Leon, and thank you, Rosemary and Holly. This third model or this new model seems good for me, but I'd like, if you don't mind, to have the same analytic work that you did between the designator and the membership model that you did for us on those slides. If you can do the same and show us what are the problems solved by this unique member model, what are the problems that will be solved by this model? I understand it more or less by your speech here, but it is better to have it written so that we will be sure what we are dealing with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tijani. Holly or Rosemary, do you want to react to that?
Oh, yes, please. That's a great idea, and we were not authorized to present a new model to you at this stage. We've obviously given it some thought, and we would be very happy to present slides so that you could compare all three models. For example, we could add a column to the chart that was towards the end of the presentation. We could prepare slides that would be as much as possible laying out the pros and cons kind of the way we did in slides 15 and 16. We'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. Next one to you, I have Matthew. Matthew?
Thank you, Leon, and thank you, Rosemary and Holly, for the outstanding work. I think we'll have to decide on whether we certify the question on this third model. I have noted on the chat and in various other discussions mentions of options relating to using the delegate option, and would like to ask you for advice whether you think that this would be a valuable option to also investigate and why, or if this approach you think would not provide a lot of benefit compared to the existing ones currently being investigated.
I give it to you. Yes, please do.
The delegate option was raised quite early in the process, and if you go, I can't give you a site off the top of my head, but we can certainly dig one out where we discussed the delegate option. And what we said there is basically that the way the statute, first of all, outside of a religious corporate context, and there's a separate set of rules for religious corporations, outside of that, delegates are representatives of members. And so really a delegate structure is just a refinement of a membership structure. I realize that the way the statute is drafted could make you think that it's actually a different thing, but in practice, it's not used that way. The way delegate structures are used is where you have such a large membership that you can no longer practically expect members to even meet. And member meetings are a key part of most membership organizations. They haven't come up in our discussion because you're talking about such a small number of members, 5 or 7 or even 1. So membership meeting doesn't mean much in that context. But where the typical membership organization, and for example, when people have wanted to talk about being able to allow members of the public to become members of ICANN, you would absolutely have to design some kind of a delegate structure, because you can't get all the people who might choose to become individual members of ICANN into a room or even many, many Adobe Connect rooms and huge conference calls. I mean, it gets totally unmanageable. So a delegate structure is designed to channel those membership rights through these delegates who represent the members. So I don't see, I mean, we looked at this quite early, and that's, I don't blame anyone for not remembering, because it is buried. But we were asked a question about delegates very early on and addressed it and concluded it was not, did not appear to us as a legal matter to be an apt tool to use in this situation?
Thank you very much, Rosemary. Next in the queue, I have Avi and Ed. We are almost reaching the top of the hour, so I would kindly ask you to keep it short so we can then turn back to Matthew for closure. Avi, could you please take the floor?
Okay, thank you. This is Avi speaking. I'm very interested in hearing more about this community as a single member model. I'm especially interested in hearing some exposition of how it might work and, for example, how seats within that might be fairly picked in terms of, and fairly picked so that the wider community, those that aren't already insiders, have some voice in it. And what kind of thresholds it would need to make decisions to be in a basis where it itself couldn't become a mob and go rogue. And basically still self-destroy the organization. So I'm interested in hearing more, but I don't quite understand how it saves us from some of the pitfalls that I currently believe are the case in the membership model. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Avery. I think this will be something long from the lawyers, but if you could please provide quick feedback, and then, of course, we will be discussing this in a more wider way. And I just would like to point that the queue is now closed with Alan Greenberg. So we're close to the queue with Alan. So would you like to react to this, Rosemary?
Yeah, this is Holly. Look, Aubrey raises a good point, but I think it's a point that we have to consider for the other models as well, and that is the point of how are you defining community? The reference proposal speaks of SOs and ACs primarily as the entities that are exercising voting rights, decision rights within the community mechanism. Now, I take it from Avery's questions that she has concerns about that. So that this is concern about the broader community, the non-SO and ACs parts of the ICANN community, plays out in a much broader fashion and has and is something to consider for all of the models that we have under discussion. It's not unique to a sole membership model, to an empowered SOAC membership model, or even to a designator model. And I just put that out as clarification from an and then it would be helpful to have additional guidance.
Thank you very much, Holly. Next in the queue, I have Ed and then Alan Greenberg, and then the queue is closed. I see that Robin raised her hand, but we're almost at the top of the hour, so I would kindly ask if you could continue this offline, or if it's really, really fast, then we would certainly allow you to raise your question, Robin. Ed, could you please take the floor?
Thanks, Leon. Hi, everybody. Rosemary, I want to refer you to the February 7th memo from Jones Day entitled Initial Responses to the Community Working Group's California Law Question. And the reason I want you to do that, perhaps not in this call, but perhaps on list, is Jones Day states clearly, I'm quoting, alternatively, if the community determined that ICANN should modify its current corporate structure in a less dramatic manner, referring to membership, ICANN's bylaws could provide for the appointment of delegates under California law. These delegates could have some or all of the authority of members. You just told us, well, you can read it that way, but that's not how they do it. Jones Day disagrees, apparently. When you take a look at what delegates could provide, we could have all the power of memberships, but we could get rid of things that people don't want, perhaps derivatives, or the dissolution of corporations. So I would ask that you take another look at the delegate structure and explain to us why your view and the view of Jones Day is different. Thank you.
May I?
Thank you very much, Ed. Yes, you may.
We were aware of the Jones Day view when we came to our conclusion. And you're correct. The two firms disagree. And I can provide...
Thank you very much, Rosa.
We go into it more, but, I mean, I think for purposes of this, you're right. We do disagree.
Thank you. Maybe it would be useful to continue this offline. Then I have Alan Greenberg. Alan, could you please...
Thank you very much. I just want to raise a concern I have, and I think we need at some point to focus on it. We have a moderately small number of ACs and SOs to begin with in ICANN. So the superset of those who are going to participate is not a large number. Based on what a number of the ACSOs have said or implications of how they are organized, the number who will actually participate, and this is true in the designator model, the membership model, or the community council, is a much smaller number. And I think we have to focus on that as we make our decision, that we may be working with a significant subset of the overall ACs and SOs and understand how that, what the implications of that are in making our choice. That's all I wanted to say, but I don't think we can ignore it because we're talking about what may be a very small number. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Any reactions to this, Holly, real quick?
Well, I certainly agree that that's a concern that the community should consider in evaluating any of the models. Who is going to participate and in what form, at what level are they going to participate, and is that satisfactory? So I think it's a good point.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. Last on the queue is Robin Gross. Robin, could you please take the floor?
Hi, can you hear me?
We do listen to you.
Okay, I'll be very brief. I just have a quick question for confirmation about what's on the table, what we're looking at in Paris. So I just wanted confirmation that we are looking at an empowered designator that explores pre-approval rights for budget and strategic plan as our options, since we're exploring all of our options and all of our alternatives, that's one that's on the table, and hopefully we can have some discussion about how far we can get on under that potential model. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Any reactions to that, Holly or Rosemary?
I think we are expecting the leadership team or this group or whatever to tell us what you want us to address on the table.
Thank you very much.
There have been a lot of people asking for an awful lot of stuff during this call, and I'm not sure which ones, there's consensus around investing more legal time looking at. Do you want us to look at delegates? Do you want us to look at pre-approval powers? I think there's a couple of other ideas that have been floated. We can do whatever you ask us to do, although obviously our time is limited, so the depth in which we can do any of it is going to depend on how many things you ask us to look at.
And in addition, I would add to that, we heard interest in expanding out our discussion of the members of the sole member model. Like, again, Rosemary, I agree. What we need is for the group to provide guidance.
Thank you very much. There's an echo, so if you can mute your mics if you're not speaking. I will now turn to Mathieu, and I do believe that we will be certifying a couple of questions and work for the lawyers at this point. I see that Chris and Caboose have had their hands raised, but unfortunately we are already at the top of the hour. So I would kindly ask for your consideration on taking this offline, and I will turn now to Mathieu. Mathieu?
Thank you, Leon. Very shortly, because we're already at the top of the hour, and to answer independent counsel question about what's the next steps and what we feel the group is requesting. I think number one, I sense traction to certify the further investigation in writing of the model with the community as a single member. Taking into account the various questions that were raised in the chat and during the call that were related to this model. So I think we have sufficient traction for that, and that will be valuable ahead of Paris, so that we can also have this on the table and before we define what we move the reference model we'll use for the public comment too. Second thing which I would like to ask independent counsel based on this call is that we take a suggestion that was made to have a strengths and weaknesses recap of the analysis on the now three models that would certainly help us focus on the benefits and the concerns that are associated with each model rather than only preference. And saying that, I would stop there at this point in terms of additional requests, because I sense that the delegate options is triggering legal controversy. So I don't think we should go any further, because otherwise we're going to get conflicting legal advice on a model. And, I mean, no consensus can be built on conflicting legal advice at this very early stage. So it's too uncertain to proceed, and I would suggest we act that this is not an option that we're going to proceed on because of that. Second item is Robin's suggestion about pre-approval rights. I think this would be a change in the requirements of our very initial proposal, so before any certification of that, in terms of legal research, I think we need to get back to the requirements and the power discussion in Work Party 1, because I remember a number of objections to pre-approval rights for budget and strategic plans, which were related to potential budget paralysis and the duration of the process to have the budget approved, which was a concern voiced by many, especially in the meeting in Istanbul. So for this pre-approval rights discussion, I would turn back to Work Party 1 and really encourage everyone to focus on what was the feedback we got in the public comment on that matter. And I think that would be the action items that I would suggest that we take from this call, which was extremely useful, in my opinion, to get a broader view but also a deeper understanding of the various implications and a good way to set the stage for a productive meeting in Paris. And so I would, with that, Leon, I see many hands raised, but I think many of them are old hands, so I'm a bit confused about whether these are reactions to these conclusions or anything.
I believe, Matthew, if I may jump in, I believe that some hands are all hands, and I assume Ed's hand is an all hand, Robin's also is an all hand, and Kabu's hand is also an all hand. So
to answer, I can answer Kabu's question in the chat. Yes, out of the meeting in Paris, we must have a reference model. If we don't, then, I mean, our timeline is just broken. So that is going to be one of the key efforts in Paris.
We'll Mathieu, it's Chris. Could you answer my questions? I just want to be clear. I heard you say that there's a legal dispute on a particular thing. We need to take that off the table. What thing was that?
That was the delegate option.
Okay, thank you. That's fine. Understood. Thank you.
And regarding Robin's question, as I said, I think the question about pre-approval of budget and strategic plan is more a requirement question and a change in the requirements as we define them and we got public comment on. And I think there needs to be a requirement discussion if it's necessary, but it's too early to get a legal research done on this until we have confirmed whether our requirement is pre-approval right or veto right. And so far we've always advocated and pushed forward requirements that were veto rights on the budget and strategic plan. So a significant change like this, I think, should not go straight to the lawyers, but rather be discussed at requirement level.
Mathieu, it's Chris again. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can I ask that we check with Holly and Rosemary that they are clear, that they have what they believe to be clear instructions about what to do between now and Paris? I think it's important that they understand what it is they want us, we want them to do.
Rosemary, Holly?
Yes. So what I understand is that you'd like us to work on the strengths and weaknesses of the three models, including the single member model that we talk of today, and do a further presentation on how that one might work as well. I wondered, that's my big takeaway, those two aspects of the work to do. I wonder if you also want us to try to come up with a set of questions that we might ask you all to think about, to help think about what direction you might be going.
Yes.
So we could, sort of guided discussions to almost like a decision tree. If you've decided this, then this, then this, does it help us get to a more focused reference model?
I think that's an excellent idea.
Okay.
But that's what I heard. I heard that pre-approval rights, we need to wait until the group comes to some consensus about it, whether it's something that they would rather have. And also on the delegate issue, that's on hold unless you tell us that you want more. And if I may say, I don't think Rosemary was saying so much, it can't be done. I think she was saying that from what we understood early on, it was a model that you folks weren't that interested in because it didn't solve some of the key issues that you were concerned about, one being how does an SO or AC control delegate. But in any event, just throw that out there.
Thanks.
And if I may ask that all this can be sent prior to Paris meeting so that we can read it before the meeting?
Yes, Tijani, I think we should apply the frozen deadline on 14th of July to that input.
Excellent.
And we will confer with the independent counsel whether there is a need for a sort of an interim update between chairs and lawyers to answer any clarifying questions they may have. We'll work towards trying to provide this in advance of the meeting. Now that we have some clarity about this model, I think that would be easier. Okay, I think with that, it was a very dense call, a lot of food for thought, and certainly many things that I'm sure we'll get back to the list and discuss. And I'd like to thank everyone for their questions, our independent counsel, Rosemary, Holly, but also the whole team behind them for working expeditiously and providing us such a clear presentation. And I look forward to talking to all of you very soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye-bye.